than the government we see. Meanwhile, the bureaucracies grow more powerful. When I first started studying the DEA, I looked at its predecessor organization, the Bureau of Narcotics, which was created in 1930. It had a $3 million budget and 300 agents up until 1968. Now there are 600 agents in New York City alone, and the industry is so profitable that Congress gives the DEA around $20 billion annually. It has something called the Special Operations Division, which was featured by Reuters a couple of days ago. The DEA's Special Operations Division was created in 1994 to go after Pablo Escobar. It was a unit of about 12 people from the CIA, FBI, and NSA, organized on the Phoenix model. It used the latest surveillance technology to find Escobar. Over the last 20 years, the SOD has become a giant Phoenix-type center in the DEA with hundreds of agents. Through the NSA, they listen in on everyone's conversations on the pretext that someone might have something to do with drug trafficking. This information is used for political and economic purposes by the bureaucrats who have run these operations for 10 years. After they get out of the NSA or DEA or CIA, the bosses go to work for corporations that benefit from the knowledge they've acquired through these secret surveillance operations, because despite what they say publicly, they are not throwing away the extraneous information. They're using it for their personal benefit. It really pays nowadays to get involved in the domestic spy business as a DEA or a CIA agent, because you're set for life. It's another way the CIA has corrupted our society. Jimenez, absolutely. Regarding the correlation between the DEA, CIA, and NSA, a story broke this week that the NSA is indeed feeding the DEA information that they're collecting through these wiretapping programs to go after a small drug smuggler. That sort of information to someone like you, Doug, who has been following the history of this, probably comes as no surprise at all. Valentine, in my book, I tell how the NSA and DEA were doing that in 1970. It's nothing new. What's so dangerous is that the intelligence that the DEA gets from the CIA and the NSA is inadmissible in court. The CIA can promote a drug trafficker and use him as an agent simply by wiretapping him. If the CIA wiretaps a drug trafficker, the DEA can't take him into court, and the guy has a license to deal. At first, the DEA was upset, but after 10 years, the executives saw the writing on the wall and joined in the fun and games. The CIA corrupted the DEA the same way it corrupts foreign governments. The CIA is corrupting the NSA and the military in the same fashion. It corrupts our bureaucracies the same way it corrupts foreign governments. They say it's for national security, but really it's for the money. It's gotten to the point where the Justice Department allows the DEA to lie. They can't say they acquired the evidence from a CIA wiretap, which they did, so they say they acquired it from a confidential informant whose name they say they can't reveal. They present that fiction as evidence in court. The judges, who've also been corrupted, won't ask where it came from, and the defendant goes to jail for 20 years. The moral to the story is that you don't have to commit a crime anymore to go to prison. The law enforcement agencies can frame you and send you to prison for thinking bad thoughts. The powers that be coordinate all the bureaucracies on the Phoenix model, and they've all been corrupted because it's the most effective way to ensure political control. If the bureaucrats subvert the Bill of Rights, they can own two houses and afford a trophy wife, send their kids to the best colleges. All our democratic institutions are so corrupt, are involved in so many illegal activities, that their main focus now is how to keep it quiet. Jimenez, earlier you called the CIA a criminal conspiracy, and I think that's true. As you just mentioned, this is how the social order is kept through engineered instability, even within our own country. So much of what was once criminal has become standard operating procedure. Just to emphasize your points about information gathering and intelligence, Russell Tice, an NSA whistleblower, did an interview with Peter B. Collins and Sybil Edmonds of Boiling Frogs Post a few weeks back, in which he said all content in all our conversations, telephone, electronic, or otherwise, is indeed being collected and stored. Not only that, but they're targeting everyone in the country, including politicians, congressmen, even Barack Obama himself from the time he was a senator. So to emphasize your point again, this is about corrupting and or compromising the leaders of a country to keep them under control. We can look at the FBI program, COINTELPRO, and how it targeted political groups like the Black Panthers. When they were thoroughly destabilized and discredited and splintered, members of the Black Panthers went on to form the Bloods, the Crips in South Central and elsewhere around the country. All of this is connected and explains how we ended up in the mess we're in. Earlier I laughed when we were talking about this, but that's just a defense mechanism to keep from screaming at this insanity. Valentine. Another defense mechanism is to read the right books, like Sam Greenlee's book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. 40 years ago, black people were aware of everything that is happening now. Nothing has changed for them, except the bureaucracies that repress them are more powerful. As I've mentioned elsewhere, from the time the Bureau of Narcotics was created in 1930 until 1968, black agents were not allowed to become managers and supervise whites. Drug law enforcement has always been run by supremacists for the purpose of incarcerating blacks and Mexicans and anyone considered inferior. Nothing has changed. The presence of a black president hasn't changed these bureaucracies. They still exist with that purpose in mind, and despite appearances, that's still the policy. Jimenez, I understand. In closing, I'd like to read from the final chapter of the Phoenix Program. It's the perfect way to end this conversation. I'd like folks to listen and consider what is happening not just in other parts of the world today, but within our own borders as well. You finish the book with this paragraph. Where can Phoenix be found today? Wherever governments of the left or the right use military and security forces to enforce their ideologies under the aegis of anti-terrorism. Look for Phoenix wherever police checkpoints ring major cities, wherever paramilitary police units patrol in armored cars. This sounds like Boston just a few months ago. And wherever military forces are conducting counterinsurgency operations. Look for Phoenix wherever emergency decrees are used to suspend due process, wherever dissidents are interned indefinitely, and wherever dissidents are rounded up and deported. Look for Phoenix wherever security forces use informants to identify dissidents, wherever security forces keep files and computerized blacklists on dissidents, wherever security forces conduct secret investigations and surveillance on dissidents, and wherever security forces, or thugs in their hire, harass and murder dissidents, and wherever such activities go unreported by the press. So again, just take that in and consider what is happening not just around the world, but within this country, in this supposed land of the free and home of the brave. So, Doug, your final thoughts on this before we wrap this up. Valentine. I'd say it's all about consciousness. It sounds like a fake term from the 60s, but if you become aware of the problem, you'll see the way out. Chapter 14. Project Gunrunner. Ken McCarthy. Welcome to Brass Check TV. Our guest today is Doug Valentine. The story we're going to talk about is Project Gunrunner and Operation Fast and Furious. Gunrunner started under the Bush administration and continued under Obama, and here's the story. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms allowed and encouraged people with criminal backgrounds and known connections to Mexican cartels to buy guns from shops in Arizona and send them to Mexico. More than 1,000 military-grade weapons were involved. Not only did the ATF allow it, the gun store owners in Arizona were concerned. They'd tell the ATF, this guy keeps coming by and buying 20 or 30 AK-47s. Can you look into him? He seems to have a criminal background. And the ATF would get back and say, let him buy them. Some of the guns ended up in Mexico. Some were involved in crimes. In one case, a U.S. border agent was killed by one of these guns. That's the official story. Now it's come out that about a dozen drug cartels in Mexico were operating independently of one another for years. They were prosperous and stayed out of each other's hair. Everybody was happy. Then in 2006, a war broke out and they started killing each other and a lot of Mexican civilians as well. About 50,000 people have been killed, often in a very gruesome manner. One of the cartels, Los Zetas, has an interesting pedigree. It is made up of people who were trained by the U.S. Special Forces. They were trained to kill drug cartel leaders, and then decided they'd rather run their own cartel. A member of the Sinaloa cartel, Vicente Zambada Niebla, is currently in prison in the U.S. on charges of trafficking more than $1 billion in cocaine and heroin. Zambada's attorney is saying that since the late 1990s, the Sinaloa cartel has provided various U.S. law enforcement agencies with information about the other cartels. They help the U.S. eliminate their rivals, and in exchange they're allowed to import limitless quantities of drugs into the U.S. Chicago is one of their main drop-off points. So, Doug, has there ever been a case when the U.S. government, through its various law enforcement agencies, gave a pass to drug dealers in exchange for something else? How often does it happen, and how far back does this go? Valentine. An old FBN agent, Lenny Schreier, once told me, "The only way you can make cases is if your informant sells dope." So yes, not only has it happened, and not only does it still happen, but giving dealers a free pass to deal drugs is the foundation stone upon which federal drug law enforcement is based. Once you realize that, you have to look beyond at the political and economic context that makes such an extra-legal practice possible. Allow me to explain. In the 1920s, the U.S. threw its weight behind Chiang Kai-shek, whose Kuomintang party was fighting the communists and several other warlords for control of China. The U.S. was competing with the other colonial nations for control of China, which had a cheap labor force and represented billions in profits for U.S. corporations and investors. The problem was the Kuomintang supported itself through the opium trade. It's well documented in the diplomatic cables between the U.S. government and its representatives in China. Historians Kinder and Walker said the commissioner of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, clearly knew about the ties between Chiang and opium dealers. Anslinger knew that Shanghai was the prime producer and exporter to the illicit world drug markets through a syndicate controlled by Du Yuesheng, a crime lord who facilitated Chiang's bloody ascent to power in 1927. As early as 1932, Anslinger knew that Chiang's finance minister was Du's protector. He'd had evidence since 1929 that American Tongs were receiving Kuomintang narcotics and distributing it to the mafia. Middlemen worked with opium merchants, gangsters like Du, Japanese occupation forces in Manchuria, and Dr. Lansing Ling, who supplied narcotics to Chinese officials traveling abroad. In 1938, Chiang Kai-shek appointed Dr. Ling head of his narcotic control department. In October 1934, the Treasury attaché in Shanghai submitted reports implicating Chiang Kai-shek in the heroin trade to North America. In 1935, the attaché reported that the superintendent of maritime customs in Shanghai was acting as agent for Chiang Kai-shek in arranging for the preparation and shipment of the stuff to the United States. These reports reached Anslinger's desk, so he knew which KMT officials and trade missions were delivering dope to American Tongs and which American mafia drug rings were buying it. He knew the Tongs were kicking back a percentage of the profits to finance Chiang's regime. After Japanese forces seized Shanghai in August 1937, Anslinger was even less willing to deal honestly with the situation. By then, Du was sitting on Shanghai's municipal board with William J. Keswick, a director of the Jardine Matheson Shipping Company. Through Keswick, Du found sanctuary in Hong Kong, where he was welcomed by a cabal of free-trading British colonialists whose shipping and banking companies earned huge revenues by allowing Du to push his drugs on the hapless Chinese. The revenues were truly immense, according to Colonel Joseph Stilwell, the U.S. military attaché in China. In 1935, there were 8 million Chinese heroin and morphine addicts and another 72 million Chinese opium addicts. Anslinger tried to minimize the problem by lying and saying that Americans were not affected. But the final decisions were made by his bosses in Washington, and from their national security perspective, the profits enabled the Kuomintang to purchase $31 million worth of fighter planes from arms dealer William Pauley to fight the communists, and that trumped any moral dilemmas about trading with the Japanese or getting Americans addicted. It's all documented. Check the sources I cite in my books. Plus, U.S. congressmen and senators in the China lobby were profiting from the guns for drugs business, too. They got kickbacks in the form of campaign funds, and in exchange, they looked away as long as Anslinger told them the dope stayed overseas. After 1949, the China lobby manipulated public hearings, and Anslinger cooked the books to make sure that the People's Republic was blamed for all narcotics coming out of the Far East. Everyone made money, and after 1947, the operation was run out of Taiwan with CIA assistance. The U.S. government's involvement in the illicit drug business was institutionalized during World War II. While serving on General Joseph Stilwell's staff in 1944, Foreign Service officer John Service reported from Kunming, the city where the Flying Tigers and OSS were headquartered, that the nationalists were totally dependent on opium and incapable of solving China's problems. Service's reports contributed to the Truman administration's decision not to come to Chiang Kai-shek's rescue at the end of the war. In retaliation, Chiang's intelligence chief, General Tai Li, had his agents in America accuse Service of leaking the Kuomintang's battle plans to a leftist newsletter. Service was arrested. After Service was cleared of any wrongdoing, the China lobby persisted in attacking his character for the next 6 years. He was subjected to 8 loyalty hearings and dismissed from the State Department in 1951. Service's persecution was fair warning that anyone linking the nationalist Chinese to drug smuggling would at a minimum be branded a communist sympathizer and his reputation ruined. That is how the U.S. drug operation is still protected today, although security for the operation has improved and whistleblowers are smeared in other ways. After World War II, the business of managing the government's involvement in the illicit narcotics trade was given to the CIA because it could covertly conduct support operations for, among others, the nationalist Chinese in Taiwan. The CIA also relocated and supplied one of Chiang's armies in Burma. This KMT army supported itself through the opium trade, and the CIA flew the opium to places where it was converted to heroin and sold to the mafia. The other bureaucracies, the military and the departments of state, justice, and treasury, provided protection, along with the China lobby congressmen and senators who controlled the little information that was made public. Mexico fits into this equation. The history of U.S. relations with Mexico is the determinant factor in why the drugs for guns business is booming in Mexico right now. It has a lot to do with the United States treating Mexico not as the kind of ally nationalist China was against the communists, but as an ongoing threat that needs to be perpetually destabilized. The U.S. has been destabilizing Mexico since Mexico made slavery illegal. American slaves were escaping into Mexico, and the southern states saw this as an act of war. Militias from the southern states would launch raids into Mexico to get their slaves back, and Mexico would give the slaves sanctuary. There is a big dose of traditional U.S. racism involved. Mexicans are considered inferior. They are said to be uneducated, and all immigrants are criminals and poor. So that's a big element, too. The animosity grew in World War I when Mexico entered into relations with Germany. Check out the famous Zimmermann telegram. Since then, the U.S. has been wary that Mexico, with its impoverished population, harbors communist sympathies. It does everything it can to prop up the elite and help it brutalize the lower classes and keep them down so they can't organize themselves politically and economically. With help from the government, U.S. corporations bribe the elite who run the civic and political institutions so that Mexico can never support progressive nations in Latin America. The 1968 Tlatelolco massacre in Mexico City is an example of the CIA's efforts to stifle political reform in Mexico. CIA heretic Phil Agee witnessed the event and wrote about it. It was Mexico's version of Tiananmen Square, but the 300 demonstrators who were gunned down were said to be communists, so the bloodbath was, in the American press, said to be justifiable. As Ronald Reagan was fond of saying, Mexico is our backyard. People were made to fear that Mexican labor leaders, Farmers and sociologists were about to invade and conquer us, so we had to slaughter them in self-defense. That's the context you have to see these things in. It's communism versus capitalism, white versus black. Donald Trump plays on the same fears today. McCarthy. So Fast and Furious was not just a gun sting operation that went awry. Supposedly, the U.S. goal, according to Vicente Zambada Niebla's attorney, was to create a mega cartel. Does that make sense in some way, based on your experience of watching how these things unfold? Valentine. I think the CIA is the mega cartel. It might serve the CIA's purposes to have one central cartel in Mexico. But certainly, no other organization in the world knows as much about drug trafficking. The CIA has computer systems that contain every bit of information about every trafficker and trafficking group. It knows where they bank and where they invest. It can predict their moves, whether in Afghanistan or Mexico. It uses all this information to manipulate events. Since 1973, the CIA has been in control of U.S. narcotics intelligence worldwide. The function was taken away from the DEA and given to the CIA, which is the unseen hand in this Fast and Furious melodrama. The ATF and DEA are straw men in this drama. As law enforcement agencies, they're shoved out in front of the CIA. But it's the CIA and State Department that arrange what's happening in Mexico, because quite simply, U.S. law enforcement agencies have no authority in Mexico. The State Department's concerns about political relationships in the region trump any law enforcement concerns. Any time a law enforcement operation is conducted in a foreign nation, it has to be approved by the State Department and the CIA. The CIA has the final say on anybody being recruited by any U.S. law enforcement agency in Mexico. If I'm in the DEA or ATF and I want to recruit the Sinaloa cartel, or anyone in a cartel, I have to check with the CIA. The CIA runs a background check to find out whether the guy is working for the Russians or the North Koreans. The CIA is always worried that Mexicans are working for our enemies. You always hear about Hezbollah in Mexico. So the CIA has control over all informants recruited by the DEA and the ATF in Mexico. And the media knows this. Every reporter who works the Mexican beat knows this. But if they were to tell you, they'd be accused, like John Service or Chelsea Manning, of aiding the enemy. If they tell, they're revealing national security secrets. So the media is prevented from mentioning that the CIA plans the little melodramas you see. The script is written by politicians in the White House and Congress. The CIA carries out their illegal operations, and if one goes bust, it's pinned on some hapless law enforcement agency. So the view the public has of these operations is totally skewed. The CIA's purpose in having an informant in some Mexican cartel, or running a mega cartel, has nothing to do with law enforcement. The CIA is not a law enforcement agency. It's our mafia operating in foreign nations. I don't know which politicians and business people the CIA is backing in Mexico through these guns for drugs activities, but that's what it's about. It's about promoting politicians and business people who will enact policies helpful to America while suppressing the Mexican people. Those are the motivations behind who the CIA selects as an informant in a particular cartel. McCarthy. So the ATF, the FBI, these are the fall guys. Valentine. The others, yes. But the FBI is never a fall guy. The FBI also has an internal security mandate. Sometimes there's conflict, but the CIA will work with the FBI to pin it on someone else. The CIA's object is to make foreign nations abide by American policy. The FBI is protecting the U.S. from any leftist threats. Its counterintelligence operations spill into Mexico, but they're classified and you'll never hear about them in the news. They don't talk about the FBI in this kind of context in the news either. The FBI is the premier law enforcement branch of the U.S. government, but it has no authority over the CIA. It resisted the creation of the CIA for that reason. Under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI also denied the existence of organized crime and the mafia until 1963. It took decades to get to that point because the crooks were anti-communist and enforced racial repression. In 1951, Senator Estes Kefauver formed a committee to investigate organized crime in an attempt to delineate lines of authority. It tracked back to drug smuggling in Mexico. That's in my books. According to a 14 July 1947 State Department report, Chinese nationalist forces were at that moment selling opium in a desperate attempt to pay troops still fighting the communists. The commissioner of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, knew that Kuomintang narcotics were reaching Mexico. In a November 1946 report to Anslinger, the FBN's supervisor in New Orleans reported that many Chinese of authority and substance gained their means from this illicit trade, and that in a recent Kuomintang convention in Mexico City, a wide solicitation of funds for the future operation of the opium trade was noted. The agent listed the major Chinese traffickers by name. In February 1947, Treasury Attaché Dolor de la Grave, a former OSS officer, reported from Mexico City that three major drug rings existed, but he made no mention of Virginia Hill's connections, Albert Spitzer, and Alfred C. Blumenthal. Bugsy Siegel was killed in Virginia Hill's house on 15 June 1947. In 1939, Meyer Lansky had sent Hill to Mexico, where she seduced a number of top politicians, army officers, diplomats, and police officials. Hill soon came to own a nightclub in Nuevo Laredo and started making frequent trips to Mexico City with Dr. Margaret Chung. Mom Chung was an honorary member of the Hip Sing Tong and had served as the attending physician to the Flying Tigers, the private airline formed under China lobby luminary General Claire Chennault to fly supplies to the nationalists in Kunming, a city infused with OSS agents and opium. As investigative journalist Ed Reed reported in The Mistress and the Mafia, the FBN knew that Dr. Chung was in the narcotic traffic in San Francisco. Chung took large cash payments from Siegel and Hill and delivered Kuomintang narcotics to Hill in New Orleans, Las Vegas, New York, and Chicago. And yet, despite the fact that the FBN agents kept her under constant surveillance for years, they were never able to make a case against her. Why not? Because she was protected by her many influential friends in Washington, including Admiral Chester A. Nimitz. Agent Joe Bell, the FBN's district supervisor in Chicago, theorized that Siegel's murder paved the way to complete control of illegal narcotics distribution in California by the mafia. Bell was referring to a related drug smuggling operation Lansky initiated in Mexico in 1944 under Harold Happy Meltzer. Described as the man who most feared Bugsy's grab at Mexico, Meltzer based his operation in Laredo, as fate would have it, directly across the border from Hill's nightclub. He worked with the Mexican consul in Washington, who located suppliers and bribed border guards, and moved drugs to the mafia in California. Bankrolled by Lansky, Meltzer traveled between Mexico City, Cuba, Hong Kong, and Japan. Meltzer was an occasional CIA asset, and in December 1960, the CIA asked him to join an assassination team. His proximity to Virginia Hill in Laredo suggests that he was a recipient of Dr. Chung's Kuomintang narcotics. If that was the case, Siegel may not have been murdered by the mafia, but by agents of the U.S. government, because Bugsy's grab for control of the CIA's Mexican connection threatened to expose Dr. Chung's protected Kuomintang operation. Even the way Siegel was murdered, by two rifle shots to the head, was characterized as very un-gangster-like. Anslinger knew that Spitzer and Blumenthal were Lansky's associates, and that large opium shipments were coming out of Mexico under police escort, but the FBN did nothing. In 1948, the FBN declared that Mexico was the source of half the illicit drugs in America, but did nothing about it because the drug trade enabled the CIA, which had been created in 1947, to destabilize the Mexican government. The CIA apparently connected Captain Rafael Chavarri, founder of Mexico's version of the CIA, the Federal Security Directorate, DFS, with Mexico's top drug smuggler, Jorge Moreno Chavez. According to Peter Dale Scott, at this point, the CIA became enmeshed in the drug intrigues and protection of the DFS, its sister agency. By 1950, Chavette was receiving narcotics from the new Lansky-Luciano French connection, and the mob-connected former mayor of New York, William O'Dwyer, was now the U.S. ambassador to Mexico. All of this was known to Senator Kefauver. He and other top government officials were also aware that the government's Faustian pact with the mafia during World War II allowed the Hoods to insinuate themselves into mainstream America. In return for services rendered during the war, mafia bosses were protected from prosecution for dozens of unsolved murders, including the 11 January 1943 assassination of Il Martello publisher Carlo Tresca in New York. The mafia was a huge problem in 1951, equivalent to terrorism today. But it was also a protected branch of the CIA, which was co-opting criminal organizations around the world and using them in its secret war against the Soviets and Red Chinese. The mafia had collaborated with Uncle Sam and had emerged from World War II energized and empowered. They controlled cities across the country. Congress looked into this mess through the Kefauver Committee. Estes Kefauver was a Democratic senator from Tennessee whose goal was to run for president in 1952. His plan was to achieve favorable national attention by exposing the mafia's role in political corruption and labor racketeering. In order to embark on such a perilous mission, the ambitious senator needed only the approval of President Truman and Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat McCarran, a rabid segregationist, anti-communist, and linchpin in the China lobby. A conservative with no love for big city Democrats, McCarran recognized the self-promotional merit in Kefauver's idea. But Nevada was dominated by organized crime figures. To the extent that McCarran was facetiously referred to as the gambler's senator. So he decided to run the investigation himself. Then-Senator Joe McCarthy claimed to have a list of 205 people in the State Department who were known members of the American Communist Party. McCarran at that point became preoccupied with setting up the Internal Security Subcommittee and joining the politically more promising Communist Witch Hunt. Unable to manage both projects simultaneously, he came to terms with Kefauver. Kefauver formed the Special Committee to Investigate Organized Crime in Interstate Commerce in 1951 and immediately hit a roadblock. By investigating the so-called gambling syndicate, he was destined to expose the mafia's ties to J. Edgar Hoover's establishment patrons, so Hoover refused to let FBI agents serve as investigators for the committee. Hoover claimed he was too busy saving the country from communists and that it would be counterproductive to devote FBI resources toward investigating what he deemed to be consensual crimes, gambling and drugs. So Kefauver turned to Commissioner Anslinger for help, and Anslinger assigned his top agents as expert witnesses and investigators. Kefauver and his team of FBN agents visited the major cities and conducted their investigation, and at the end determined that the vice squad pattern gave control of vice payments to a few officials and demoralized law enforcement in general. The committee concluded that local law enforcement managed local crime and that federal agencies were powerless to stop it. Street cops were taking payoffs from pimps, gamblers, and drug dealers and kicking a percentage up to their bosses, who kicked another percentage back to the politicians who appointed them. The industrialists who put the politicians in power were happy, as long as the cops made sure the mafia sold dope to blacks and Puerto Ricans. Nothing has changed. The CIA, FBI, ATF, and DEA are performing the same function for their political bosses. They manage crime to maintain social divisions, and so capitalism can thrive. The Kefauver Committee said there's nothing we can do about it. As Guy Debord famously said, "The mafia is not an outsider in this world. It is perfectly at home. Indeed, in the integrated spectacle, it stands as the model of all advanced commercial enterprises. People have been aware of it for 65 years, but can't do anything about it because the national security state is an impregnable fortress and average citizens can't get inside. Even if you understand what's going on, 5 seconds later, you're chasing it out of your mind because there's not a thing you can do about it. We can't vote to end the secrecy that enables these rackets to exist. Clinton and Trump are rubbing it in our faces. They're saying, you can't do a damn thing about it. Cops killing blacks is unfortunate, but cops are hardly ever punished. The CIA controls the world's rackets the same way. And the federal government and its media allies keep it secret, and there's nothing you can do about it except get riled up personally. McCarthy, it's amazing how skillful they are at keeping the focus on a tiny part of the story and not even getting into the real story. It is interesting how they muddy issues. Valentine, right now America has 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. Most of them are in prison for drug-related offenses. Talk about human rights abuses. After they joined forces with the mafia, the capitalists got their congressmen to keep increasing sentencing for drug offenses. They created a vast, privatized, profitable prison industry, which in turn props up a huge law enforcement industry. Taken together, this is not freedom and democracy. Instead, the government media propaganda machine has succeeded in demonizing the people who pack the prisons just as it demonizes Muslims in order to keep the homeland security industry growing. The disenfranchised minorities who are arrested for drug offenses get court-appointed lawyers who never seriously contest their cases. They cop pleas and go to prison. Human beings are the grist for this crime mill that churns out money for investors. It's systemic corruption, just like NAFTA, which has led to increased poverty and suffering in Mexico. And this provides the pretext for a surveillance state that's equipped by companies staffed by former FBI, DEA, ATF, and CIA agents. It's creating terrorism to subvert the justice system and assure them political control of Americans. That's the domestic end of this drugs for guns boondoggle. McCarthy. So overseas, we use it as a tool of policy, supporting the people we like and eliminating the people we don't like. At home, we use it to keep people under political control. Valentine. Yep. All the evidence is there. If you look at what the CIA has done, the coups d'etat of leftist governments and alliances with crooks and fascists, and what they're doing now and what they say behind the scenes, it becomes evident that what I'm saying is fact. But the media bosses are partners in this enterprise, and they won't allow their networks to report on anything of substance. If rogues among them do, they're expelled. McCarthy. And there's the horrible example of Gary Webb. I mean, if that's not a warning to journalists, what can happen to them? Valentine. Lots of journalists have been harassed for even having hinted at the truth. Lots of other people have suffered the same way, starting with the Foreign Service officer I mentioned earlier, John Service. McCarthy. If drugs were to be decriminalized, then that whole thing goes up in smoke. You can't have all these cops on the payroll doing nothing except taking bribes. You can't have the CIA running drug cartels. They always say it would be a humanitarian disaster if we let drugs be legal. There'd be people dying in the streets from overdoses. And that's why we're keeping all this going for you. Valentine. If you look at every other country where they don't have these, to use the cliché, draconian drug laws, people are not dead in the streets with needles sticking out of their arms and coke pipes shoved up their nose. People want to live healthy lives, but political and economic factors keep them down. Discrimination and lack of economic opportunity turns segments of society to the underground drug business, both as sellers and users. Among the protected rich and famous, it's a kick and something they can get away with because they have lawyers and access to the Betty Ford Clinic. The government is creating conditions across the board that are conducive to taking drugs. The pharmaceutical industry is part of the problem, along with its co-conspirators in the advertising industry. Every time you turn on the TV, there's a commercial telling you to take a pill. The next commercial says, don't take that pill, take this pill. This is the free market at work, sucking the life out of people. It would help if the airwaves were publicly and not privately owned, and if we could get rid of all this advertising. It would help if we could nationalize the pharmaceutical industry and take the profit out of healthcare and law enforcement. Then maybe we could experience something like democracy. But as long as the vulture capitalists control the national security state and the media, that isn't going to happen. McCarthy, we started out with a limited discussion about Mexico, but once you start unraveling one thread, it really does lead to this discussion we're having, because it's not about the gun and drug running into Mexico. It's not even about the history of the U.S. supporting drug operations all over the world. It's about domination and control. It's about a few people conspiring, literally, to keep the majority of people in a controlled and controllable state. Valentine. Yep. While you're looking at this one particular shell game, 40 other shell games are going on. If they can keep you focused on the sensational operations like Gunrunner, you're not going to be looking at what's important, the big picture. McCarthy. It's all about misdirection, the greatest magician's trick. Even in warfare, the ultimate skill is to misdirect the attention of your enemy. So, Doug, thank you so much. You're the guy doing all the digging. You're the one looking at this every day, and I can understand the cynicism. But since you brought that up, if one more person understands what's going on, it's a victory. Not a massive victory, but it's a victory. Big victories have to start with small victories. Part 3. The Phoenix Foundation of Homeland Security. Such a perfect democracy constructs its own inconceivable foe, terrorism. Its wish is to be judged by its enemies rather than by its results. The story of terrorism is written by the state, and it is therefore highly instructive. The spectators must certainly never know everything about terrorism, but they must always know enough to convince them that, compared with terrorism, everything else must be acceptable, or in any case more rational and democratic. Guy Debord, Comments on the Society of the Spectacle. Chapter 15. The Spook Who Became a Congressman. Why CIA Officers Cannot Be Allowed to Hold Public Office. While running for Congress as a Republican candidate in 2000, Robert R. Rob Simmons posted on his website and in TV ads a picture of himself standing in front of an American flag in an Army uniform. The symbolic meaning was obvious. Simmons was glorifying himself as a soldier patriot above all else. But in the final week of the campaign, his identification with militancy took an unexpected turn when he was scandalized by allegations that he had committed war crimes while serving not as a soldier, but as a CIA officer in Vietnam. Simmons called the accusation a smear tactic. "Any veteran, anybody who served his country in war, should be offended," Simmons said, appealing directly to the patriotism of undecided voters in a last-ditch effort to win the election, while inadvertently castigating the CIA. Adding to his indignation was the undisputed fact that the charges had emanated from the staff of his opponent, Congressman Sam Gaydenson, who had represented Connecticut's 2nd District since 1981. Rocked by the outpouring of sympathy for Simmons, Gaydenson fired a campaign worker for inciting two college students to plan, a rally against Simmons. The students were intimidated, politically suppressed in CIA terms, into canceling their protest. The local newspaper, the New London Day, headlined the Gaydenson aspect of the story, calling it a dirty trick, but refusing to delve into the substance of the charges. So I wrote to the editor and said that I'd interviewed Simmons 12 years earlier. I offered to write an article about him, but the newspaper decided to wait until after the election. It seemed like the newspaper was trying to help Simmons win the election, and win he did. Though trailing in the week before the election, he won by less than 3,000 votes. It was the allegation that he was a torturer that propelled him to victory. God Bless America. When The Day finally featured a story on Simmons's sordid CIA past, it admitted that the war crimes charge wasn't a dirty trick, but stemmed from a profile of Simmons The Day itself had published in 1994. In a rare moment of candor, Simmons in 1994 had confessed that while managing the Fujian Province Interrogation Center, PIC, he would threaten to withhold medicine from injured prisoners in order to obtain information. But, he added piously, he never made good on the threat. According to Simmons, a coercive tactic like threatening to withhold medical treatment did not reach the threshold of a war crime. On the contrary, if I hadn't involved myself, many people would have lost their limbs or their lives, Simmons said with a straight face. Simmons's denial was enough for the day. It didn't ask if he'd withheld medicine for hours or days, or if his victims included children and the elderly. It wasn't concerned with the guilt or innocence of the people Simmons abused, or if they were forced to sign false confessions to stop the bleeding. Steeped in the same racist stereotypes that military propagandists spewed during the war, the newspaper assumed that every Vietnamese in the PIC was a terrorist deserving of whatever atrocities were committed against him or her. They were all trying to kill heroic Americans like Rob Simmons, weren't they? I wasn't surprised by the newspaper's shenanigans. From the time the Phoenix program was published in 1990, I'd witnessed a gradual escalation of belligerent nationalistic rhetoric, accompanied by an outpouring of revisionist Vietnam War history. The reactionary Reagan, Bush, and Clinton regimes had waged a series of increasingly militant and covert action initiatives, from El Salvador to Iraq to Serbia, in a calculated and well-publicized attempt to purge the Vietnam syndrome from the fragile American psyche. The floodgates opened in the wake of 9/11. Suddenly, the practice of withholding medicine became CIA's standard operating procedure as part of the Bush-Cheney-Rumsfeld repertoire of torturous, enhanced interrogation techniques. Torture became so popular that in 2003, the U.S. Supreme Court approved the practice of withholding medical treatment for domestic law enforcement purposes. In a 6-3 decision, the court exonerated several California cops who'd withheld medical treatment from a Hispanic suspect they'd shot 5 times. The cops, like Simmons, claimed they were merely trying to get him to talk. Withholding medical treatment, however, was not always applauded by American militarists as a cool way of coercing bad guys. When John McCain ran for president in 2008, withholding medical treatment was characterized as the dastardly sort of thing only subhuman commies would do. McCain, who spent 5.5 years in captivity in North Vietnam, was shot down while dropping bombs on civilians in the heart of Hanoi. Taken prisoner with fractures in his right leg and both arms, he received minimal care and was kept in wretched conditions. As he tearfully recalled, they kept saying, "You will not receive any medical treatment until you talk." McCain suffered. "I thought that if I just held out, that they'd take me to the hospital. I was fed small amounts of food by the guard and also allowed to drink some water. I was able to hold the water down, but I kept vomiting the food. I looked at my knee. It was about the size, shape, and color of a football. I remembered that when I was a flying instructor, a fellow had ejected from his plane and broken his thigh. He had gone into shock. The blood had pooled in his leg, and he died, which came as quite a surprise to us, a man dying of a broken leg. Then I realized that a very similar thing was happening to me." McCain cracked. Thereafter known as Songbird, McCain told the guards, "I'll give you military information if you will take me to the hospital." I've repeated McCain's sorrowful story to show how easy it was for the day to manipulate information to minimize the charge against Simmons. We didn't hear the screams of pain and fear in the background like we did in McCain's account. Simmons's victims were given no voice at all. This magical ability to portray the same thing as good in one case and bad in another is the essence of the political and psychological warfare campaign being waged against Americans by rehabilitated war criminals like Simmons and McCain and their supporting cast in the Old Boy Network that has manipulated public opinion for 70 years. But the differences between McCain and the Vietnamese Simmons tortured are that McCain was wounded while terror bombing innocent civilians in a major city in a foreign country, while Simmons remained unscathed, and the people he terrorized were snatched from their homes at midnight or in Phoenix roundups. As his well-rehearsed story illustrates, Simmons is an expert at dissembling, which, as I explained to the day, is why he shouldn't have been allowed to hold public office. He can't be trusted to tell the truth about anything. But the sad fact is that many Americans are soothed by the double standard, which absolves them of complicity in the crimes their country commits. What's worse is that he has legions of allies in the media to censor his critics, fellow CIA officers to back his alibi, and corrupted historians to lend an air of authenticity to his propaganda. Stated policy versus operational reality. Early in my research into the Phoenix program, I filed an FOIA with the CIA, asking it to release all its records about the PICs. That request was denied. 40 years after they were abandoned, the PICs are still as big a secret as what happened inside the Gulag archipelago of black sites the CIA built after 9/11 in 8 countries, including Thailand, where Al-Qaeda commander Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded, Afghanistan, and several democracies in Eastern Europe. The CIA will never release to the public its secret files about the PICs, which certainly served as models for its black sites. And even if it did release them, they should not be believed. CIA officers are trained never to incriminate themselves in written reports or spoken words. Not to do so, after all, is key to achieving plausible deniability. The way to understand the operational realities of running a PIC, as opposed to the stated policies Simmons and his co-conspirators cite chapter and verse, is by studying the political, psychological, and bureaucratic contexts in which they occur. By doing so, one realizes that war crimes like those committed in the PICs are unstated but carefully crafted U.S. policy. The mindset of CIA officers and their media co-conspirators is the unifying factor in this conspiracy. McCain, the tortured, and Simmons, by the same standards, the torturer, truly believe the heroic myth they have created about themselves. Indeed, the myth of the hero has informed Western literature and philosophy since the Greek elite paid Homer to pen the Iliad and Odyssey, forever endowing the warrior class with the highest social virtues while justifying the tragic consequences of their imperial marauding as fate. Since then, the theme of the warrior hero has determined Western social development. The Old Testament would be a short story without it. How many times have Hollywood's leading men quoted the rousing speech Shakespeare had Henry V deliver to his soldiers on St. Crispin's Eve? "For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition." Being initiated into a secret society, a band of warrior brothers that exists apart from and is superior to civil society, can be intoxicating. Even Confederate soldiers are venerated as heroes, for however vile they were as individuals, they obeyed their officers and killed and died on command. Much of America's rhetorical identity as exceptional is based on this Marlboro macho man myth. What distinguishes CIA officers is their transcendent ability through their bureaucratic association with the national security establishment and its Homeric scribes in Hollywood to promulgate their myths as fact, while guaranteeing that the truth is concealed. McCain's exalted status as a U.S. senator enabled him to enact legislation that sealed thousands of documents pertaining to Vietnam War POW briefings. He claimed he did it to protect the privacy of POWs. But his real motive, according to Sidney H. Schonberg, was to keep the lid on the details of his collaboration with his captors. Simmons pulled a similar stunt. While serving as a legislative aide in the U.S. Congress, he helped author and enact the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, which makes it a crime to name CIA agents. It was already a crime to report CIA sources and methods, but this act added another layer of legal chainmail to the protective shield already separating CIA officers from the consequences of their crimes. Once they are safely ensconced in this legally gated community, they have only to sculpt their Boy Scout persona. Every crime boss knows how to act in front of the press. In 1958, reporter Dom Frasca managed to get an interview with Vito Genovese just before he went to prison for drug trafficking. Don Vito, liked golf, wore yellow-tinted glasses, and lived alone in a 5-bedroom cottage. He did his own cooking, mostly traditional Italian dishes. 8 grandkids often visited. When Frasca asked him about the rackets, Vito blamed all his troubles on his ex-wife going through menopause. Most significantly, Vito's wry humor kept Frasca at an impeccable distance without offending. It's easy to put on an act. The best politicians, criminals, and CIA officers do it naturally. The problem for the rest of us is that over time, the actors come to believe it. The myths they internalize are the fatal lie in the soul Plato warned about. Fate isn't what makes someone murder and torture for profit. It is deceiving oneself into believing one has no choice. Not everyone is a victim of this mass delusion. Warren Milberg, a CIA officer I interviewed for the Phoenix program, told me how in 1967, the Pentagon invited him and 2 other Air Force officers to join a secret CIA counterinsurgency program in Vietnam. Volunteers were given extensive training and sent to Vietnam to serve at the discretion of senior CIA officers in Saigon and the regions. Most were assigned to the provinces as paramilitary officers. Several became Phoenix coordinators. Milberg, who identified himself as one of the protected few, joined the program. But the other 2 officers withdrew, one as a matter of conscience. Jacques Klein withdrew because he felt the means and methods that he thought were going to be used in Phoenix were similar to the means and methods used by the Nazis in World War II. Klein took individual responsibility. Simmons sacrificed his and is forever corrupted. It's that simple. What did you do in the war, Daddy? Simmons enlisted in the Army in July 1965. He went to the Army's intelligence school that fall, and upon graduating was commissioned as a first lieutenant. He arrived in Vietnam in April 1967 and served a year with the 219th Military Intelligence Detachment in Bien Ho, a major city in 3 Corps near Saigon. Simmons liked the war and volunteered for another tour, serving until December 1968 with MACV Team 96 in Canto City, where the CIA was headquartered in 4 Corps. His job was to work with South Vietnamese military and police forces to interdict the Viet Cong's secret supply system. Secret agents and smugglers were moving weapons, drugs, and other contraband through marketplaces along the Cambodian border. Simmons was successful, and as a reward, was sent to brief Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker on his findings, which led to the initiation of the Cambodian Border Watch Program. While in Canto, Simmons worked with CIA officers. "I liked the agency guys," he said to me. "They listened, and they asked the smartest questions." The CIA guys liked Simmons, too, and arranged a job interview for him at CIA headquarters. He was hired and entered the Junior Officer Trainee Program, which involved paramilitary training, handling weapons and making bombs, and intelligence training, surveillance, spycraft, running agent nets, setting up proprietary companies, etc. This was the same program Milberg joined and Klein quit. Similar programs have proliferated since 9/11. Simmons returned to Vietnam in November 1970 as a CIA officer posing as a civilian employee of the Defense Department within MACV's Pacification Security Coordination Group. He was slated to return to Canto, but a CIA officer in Fujian province had flipped out and locked himself in a room with a gun. That sorry soul was sent home, as was his predecessor. According to Simmons, the officer he replaced was fired for hitting a priest, a Don Luce type who, ironically, was at the very time investigating abuses at the Fujian PIC. Other ironies awaited Simmons. Located in 2 Corps, Fujian was a heavy VC province. CIA officers were confined to the compound, wore flak jackets, carried machine guns, periodically came under mortar attack, and had a personal force of Hnung Chinese bodyguards. Simmons was assigned to the CIA compound in Thuy Ho, the province's capital city. He did not name his boss, the province officer in charge, POIC, but described his counterpart, Special Police Chief Nguyen Tam, as a former French Foreign Legionnaire and paratrooper in the South Vietnamese Army. Tam was a tough veteran who didn't trust Simmons and could not control his freewheeling subordinates. Simmons initially reported on police corruption, but he said Morales never passed the reports to Saigon. In 1970, CIA Station Chief Ted Shackley distanced the CIA from the pacification programs it had initiated earlier in the war, including Phoenix. Negotiations for a ceasefire were underway by 1971, and the CIA receded into the shadows. Simmons was not allowed to meet the Cord's province senior advisor. Relations with military intelligence and with the special police were strained as well. Shackley told me that the CIA still oversaw Phoenix in 1972, but only to iron out problems. Was there a province chief not willing to cooperate with the PIC? Maybe there was overcrowding in a PIC that the province or region couldn't resolve. What to do? Well, the Phoenix director would go to the Secretary General of the National Police and cite specific cases. There might be a knowledgeable source in a PIC who needed to be brought to Saigon. Were the line managers looking at the dossiers? Phoenix, Shackley insisted, had nothing to do with intelligence operations. It was completely separate from Special Branch trying to penetrate the Viet Cong. Any guy who could be used as a penetration agent was spun out of Phoenix. Under Shackley, Phoenix evolved into a massive screening operation under military control, while the Special Branch had the mission of keying on important VCI political leaders and activists so as not to clog up the system with volumes of low-level VCI cadre or front members. A typical Special Branch operation began when an agent submitted a report on a VCI suspect. The Special Branch would assign people to watch him or her. Special police officers worked in two-man teams around the clock. They'd find where the suspect lived and worked and where his contact points were. Other agents were set up in business, perhaps a soup shop close to the suspect's house, or a bicycle repair shop near his favorite cafe. Places the suspect visited were kept under surveillance. The special police wanted to know, for example, if the suspect and his comrades were printing leaflets in the safe house for the Women's Revolutionary Association. If the suspect was involved in revolutionary activity, he was secretly arrested and interrogated, and ideally made to inform on his bosses. More arrests would follow, and the best candidate among them would be coerced into working for the special police as a penetration agent, secretly channeling information to his case officer, which would lead to more arrests. For security purposes, photos of the penetration agent were taken in the company of special police personnel. He/she would also be forced to sign a sworn statement indicating that he/she was working for the GVN. The photos and documents would find their way to the VCI if the agent did not cooperate in the future. Such was the nature of the spy business Simmons was in. When he arrived in Tuy Ho, his boss had three other CIA officers on his staff.